Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. My name is Andy Cutchins, and I'm the director of the Russia and Eurasia program here. And I'm really delighted to see you here early this morning, and especially my distinguished panelists. It seems that political crises in Ukraine are becoming fairly regular events, maybe not annually. We were laughing before chatting up here that this is maybe the fourth one since the Orange Revolution. It depends on how you count. But it's certainly the most significant crisis since the Orange Revolution. Steve and I were hoping to actually schedule this session earlier after President Yushchenko dissolved the Rada on April 2nd, but we couldn't get a room here at CSIS any sooner. But we felt fairly confident that the crisis would not be resolved by April 20th, and it's turned out that is the case. So let me turn things over to my distinguished panelists. We have a great program, I think, this morning. We're going to be looking at the internal dynamics of the crisis, the political dynamics in Ukraine itself. And we'll also be looking at the roles of Europe, the United States, and, of course, the Russian Federation. And maybe some of you have seen some fireworks in the last couple of days that have added some spice, at least from the Russian side. There was an article that's coming out by Yulia Tymoshenko in Foreign Affairs. It's quite an interesting article, and there's quite a blistering response from the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs to that article. And I would recommend it to you to check that out, and there may be some discussion of that today. Our first speaker will be Taras Kuzio, well known to this audience from George Washington University. And he'll be followed by Ambassador Steve Pieper, who's a senior advisor here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and certainly well-known as a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and also Deputy Assistant Secretary for Russia and Eurasia and many other significant posts on U.S. foreign policy making toward the region. And my good friend and old colleague from the Carnegie Endowment and the Carnegie Moscow Center, Dmitry Trenin, who is deputy director at the Carnegie Moscow Center and also a senior associate in Washington with the endowment. And he's here in residence for 9 or 10 months with the endowment. And we're delighted to have you here in Washington, Dmitry, and especially here this morning. So let me turn the floor over, first of all, to Taras.
And the statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry came out before the article appeared in Foreign Affairs, so they obviously had insider links.
Preemptive strike.
My brief today is to talk about Ukrainian domestic politics and why the crisis has taken place. I think there's equal blame to be laid on both President Yushchenko and Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. I won't necessarily go into the reasons why I lay equal blame on Viktor Yushchenko. I think anybody who's read my writings in the last couple of years will be able to see where the criticisms lie, but we can certainly raise those in the discussion. This is certainly the fourth crisis, at least since the election of Viktor Yushchenko. I think we do have a problem of poor leadership in the country, and there's certainly one thing which I think differentiates Ukraine's crisis today from the Russian crisis of 1993, which is wrongly compared to, and this is something that we see in Washington in particular, and something I asked the Ukrainian ambassador yesterday, is that in 1993, Boris Yeltsin was supported by the West, rightly or wrongly, in his standoff with the Russian parliament, because he was seen as a Russian reformer. Today, the West is a bit supportive, but it's still very ambivalent about Viktor Yushchenko because of 2 years of lack of leadership and lack of strategic direction and many mistakes and 3 previous crises. So there is a big difference between the two. I think that at the same time, one has to give credit to Viktor Yushchenko that, unlike Yulia Tymoshenko, who needs to be poked in the eye only once and then she'll react very ferociously and you'll never be able to poke her in the eye again, Yushchenko's taken at least 20 or more pokes in the eye, and he's now reacted. Wrongly or rightly, he's reacted. He's proposed many elements of, which I'll talk about in a minute, many elements of moderation to the anti-crisis coalition in Parliament and the government, which have been turned down. And I believe here we can, I'd like to quote an open letter by many Western former presidents and prime ministers published in the International Herald and Tribune of Tuesday of this week, which says as follows. European leaders must understand and acknowledge the context in which the crisis has arisen. President Yushchenko acted responsibly by agreeing to share power with his former rival, Viktor Yanukovych, after last year's parliamentary elections produced a stalemate. Unfortunately, Yanukovych has since used the office of prime minister to initiate a self-serving political power grab and has upset the delicate political balance of Ukrainian society. And I think this is a key factor in the reason why events moved so quickly in late March in Ukraine. Remember that when Yulia Tymoshenko spoke at the CSIS in late February, and right up until mid-March, Yulia Tymoshenko was the sole person in Ukrainian politics calling for early elections. Everything changes in the third week of March, and we have, because a consequence of that, today's crisis. The reason why we have, in effect, a political constitutional crisis, I think, can be more laid at the door of the opposition and, by virtue as well, the former Leonid Kuchma camp, than at the camp of Viktor Yushchenko. And I'll explain why. The 2004 constitution reforms produced or agreed to during roundtable negotiations brokered by the European Union were described even by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe at the time and since in the resolution just yesterday as hasty and incomplete. Maybe that there was no alternative, possibly, because of that political crisis at the time of the Orange Revolution. At the same time, since then, what we've had is that in 2005-2006, the former Kuchma camp, which then became the opposition to Yushchenko and the Orange Team, rejected any advice by the Venice Commission of the Council of Europe to improve the constitution reforms, ignored the 2005 resolution of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe to also do this. In 2005, Parliament refused to submit its quota of judges to the Constitutional Court, so the Constitutional Court couldn't function. And in 2006, under President Yushchenko, parliamentary coalition refused to join his moderate attempt at dealing with this issue by creating a constitutional commission to again improve these hasty and incomplete reforms. The reason, I think, is quite simple. Anti-crisis coalition is a coalition which is driven by the desire to create, I think, a parliamentary republic. You have two left-wing political parties in the anti-crisis coalition, and left-wing parties in that post-Soviet environment traditionally have been anti-presidential in the sense of opposed to the institution of presidency. And therefore, that coupled with, I think, the wing of the party of regions in power around Viktor Yanukovych, the so-called party of war or party of revenge, is, I think, led to this attempt to create a parliamentary constitutional majority with the aim of moving towards a parliamentary system. That was, I think, the logic driving this, the logic refusing to heed the moderating position of Viktor Yushchenko. Let's recall that Yushchenko did not adopt the more radical position of Yulia Tymoshenko, which was to call a referendum on the constitutional reforms and to abolish them, which he thought the majority of the population would agree to. So Viktor Yushchenko's even moderate attempts at dealing with this issue on constitutional issues were not taken into account by the anti-crisis coalition. And his problem was that since August of last year, the Constitutional Court has not ruled on any single issue. So every time he kept submitting questions to the Constitutional Court, for example, in the Law of Cabinet of Ministers, this was never dealt with. And so you had the build-up of all of these single problems without them being dealt with by the Constitutional Court. In the end, I think he was in many ways boxed into a corner, particularly by that third week in March when he saw the beginnings of the defection of opposition MPs to the anti-crisis coalition and the fear that soon there would be created a constitutional majority. His fear was that the second wave, and there were strong rumors at the time that people like Petro Poroshenko had been offered the Ministry of Finance and that he would become the second wave that would defect. So what do we have today? Ironically, we have the more radical view of Yulia Tymoshenko, which called for early elections right up until middle to third week of March, which was by itself and alone in Ukrainian politics, is now the view of the entire opposition. So something dramatically changed. in that second half of March. And the trigger was that third week of March when, as I mentioned, Anatoly Kinakh and the Party of Industrials and Entrepreneurs in our Ukraine defected to the Anti-Crisis Coalition, and the police raids on Yuri Lutsenko's apartment in Kiev and on his activists around Ukraine, and the kind of sense of deja vu when arms and weapons were planted in his supporters' apartments, which again resembled October 2004, when the same kind of tactic was used unsuccessfully against Pora. So what we have at the end of March coming together is that sense of quick encroachment and fear on the part of Viktor Yushchenko. We have Viktor Yushchenko, the presidential secretariat, and our Ukraine, in effect, moving over to the more radical position of Yulia Tymoshenko. And the backdrop is to what I've already really talked about. We also have internal changes taking place in our Ukraine, the marginalization of the business wing of our Ukraine, which began to control it in 2006, disastrously, for those elections, and a move more back to the Our Ukraine of 2002, where it's dominated more by national democratic forces. We see that, for example, with the election of Vyacheslav Kirilenko, who's from Yuri Kostenko's party as the leader of Our Ukraine, and we also see that in the change in the head of the presidential secretariat, who's the third in 2 years, the first manager, I would say, when you talk to people inside the secretariat, but also somebody who has more of a national democratic profile compared to Rybachuk and Zinchenko. So all of that helps in solidifying an opposition alliance, which begins to form at the end of February, just on the eve of when Yulia Tymoshenko comes to Washington. And remember, it took our Ukraine 4 months to decide that. They went into opposition in October of last year and only agreed to signing an alliance with Tymoshenko in February. So there's been a process to which we've actually reached now. So I think that many of the reasons why the decree happened on April 2nd really have to be laid at the door, and the blame has to be laid at to the door of Viktor Yanukovych. I think that Yulia Tymoshenko should actually send Prime Minister Yanukovych a big bouquet of flowers saying thank you for actually poking Viktor Yushchenko so many times in the eye that finally he reacted and moved over to the more radical position of early elections. And just to give you some examples of where the kind of issues that built up domestically. The refusal of the Anti-Crisis Coalition to join this moderate body of a constitutional commission rather than going for referendum on constitutional issues. The attempt at changing the law on the prosecutor so that the prosecutor, which under the new constitution should be under the president, moved over to parliament. Refusal to incorporate into Ukraine legislation the universal agreement, which was signed in August of last year. The attempt to create a 300 constitutional majority, which in the secretariat of the president was believed to be an attempt to move towards a parliamentary system, form parliamentary. And the law on the cabinet of ministers, of course, which again took powers, more powers away from the president. In the foreign policy domain, the unconstitutional dismissal of Boris Tarasyuk on the eve of Viktor Yanukovych's visit to Washington. The cutting off of funding to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, an event which is pretty unprecedented, I think, in international affairs. The refusal to accept the successor proposed by Viktor Yushchenko to Tarasyuk, Mr. Ohorytsko. The attempt at usurping foreign policy issues when Viktor Yanukovych travels abroad. And the attempt to adopt a new law on National Security and Defense Council, which again would take powers from the president. These were all attempts at encroaching. So what I think we had is, for Viktor Yanukovych and his coalition, it wasn't sufficient that they'd had so many powers transferred under the new constitution to parliament. They wanted even more powers. And I think this kind of view that, as we see on the International Herald Tribune open letter, is, I think, a very valid one, that they began to encroach and disrupt the balance of power in the country. And I think on the part of the presidential team, there was even a sense that this was an attempt of kind of humiliating the president. There was even a sense of anger about that as well. Where do we go from here? And I'll just finish on this issue of scenarios and such like. I think that the developments even the last few days with the withdrawal of the opposition Our Ukraine and Tymoshenko bloc from parliament and their resignations from parliament would indicate that even regardless of what the Constitutional Court decides, if and when it decides anything, And even when it decides it, only about 12% of Ukrainians will actually believe its decision was done honestly. That's another problem with the Constitutional Court. Is that the elections are bound to go ahead because the parliament does not have a quorum of 300 deputies, which it is required to do under the Constitution. So when those elections will go ahead is a different question. I think the opposition, particularly the Party of Regions, would like to have the elections maybe in the fall to maybe introduce populist decisions such as on increasing pensions, whereas the opposition and President Yushchenko would prefer it to happen in late June before the summer recess. Some kind of compromise, and this is something that we've discussed in various forums this week in Washington, is probably necessary, but that will not be able to take place without the introduction of at least some kind of Western mediation. The problem that we have is that to prevent we're in the fifth crisis now, prevent a sixth crisis in 6 months' time, and even more continuing until 2011 if we don't have elections, is that what we need is not only the tweaking and improving of the constitutional reforms which were introduced this year, we also need an all-embracing agreement to resolve all of the main problems. I think everybody's fed up, both in Ukraine and in the West, of these continuing crises. I mean, they're not unusual in democracies, but I think there is a need to prevent a further crisis down the road, and that would mean an agreement which is far broader than just constitutional issues. I think that very radical comments that we've heard about impeachment of Yushchenko, I think, are off mark. Ukraine has no legal mechanisms for impeaching a president. The law on temporary standing commissions was vetoed by both President Kuchma and President Yushchenko, so there's no legal mechanism to do it. At the same time, one could see either of two scenarios. Either Viktor Yushchenko comes out of this so well that he is able to possibly stand and maybe be successful in 2009 elections. His ratings have already doubled in the last few weeks. Or he becomes a marginalized figure if the Constitutional Court rules against him, for example. Then the baton in 2009 will be taken by Yuli Tymoshenko. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Taras. You've really set the table beautifully and laid out the dynamics of the what led up to the crisis and possible scenarios. I think now we'll turn to Steve Pfeiffer, who will look at some of the external factors. And I have to note that I think Jesse Helms must have been smiling someplace when he saw that the cutoff of funding to the Ukrainian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Okay, Steve, thanks.
You have to explain that. Okay, well, thank you, Andy. I'm happy to be here this morning, and what I will focus on is the U.S. government reaction to the crisis. Let me say, first of all, I am not speaking officially for the U.S. government. I'm a former U.S. government official describing my understanding of current U.S. policy. With the added layer of complexities, I've got at least two or three members of the U.S. government in the audience. So if you should see either Jorgen or Wayne, you know, shaking their head or kind of going like this, you misunderstood what I just said.
But you got it.
Okay. First of all, let me just begin with a basic point, which is that the U.S. government interest in Ukraine today is exactly the same as it was on April 1 throughout the Bush administration, going back really to 1994 in the Clinton administration. And that is what the United States wants to see in Ukraine as a country that develops as a stable and independent state with strong democratic institutions, a robust market economy, and good relations with its neighbors, including increasingly close ties with Europe and the Euro-Atlantic community. You know, that's the vision. And I think within the U.S. government, you know, when they look at Ukraine, there is probably some sympathy with what one might describe as the orange vision, the vision that was really out there on the Maidan of Ukraine as a democratic state fully in Europe. But having said that, what you see now is really a fight between two institutions which are essentially democratic. Yushchenko was elected in a democratic election at the end of 2004. The Rada majority emerged from an election in 2006 that was widely seen as probably the best election in Ukraine's history. So it's difficult to choose between one or the other. So the position articulated by the department spokesman and also in Kyiv is The U.S. government wants to see a peaceful resolution consistent with democratic norms and the rule of law. And in essence, it's an endorsement of process, a democratic process over a particular outcome, not choosing sides, which at this point is the correct position. If you look at European governments, most European governments have taken the same position. A couple of exceptions. The Polish president, for example, early on endorsed the idea of early elections. Now, early elections are not undemocratic, but they certainly go beyond the general position that the U.S. government has taken, and they put the Polish president really aligned with an outcome that was seen as favoring the Yushchenko position, which the U.S. government has not been prepared to do yet. Now, with that description, I could sit down and turn it over to Dmitry to talk about the Russian reaction, but let me go down one other layer to some of the concerns that one hears around Washington about what's going on in Ukraine. First of all, the crisis that you see today is not welcome here. There's frustration that the politicians across the board in Ukraine have been so obsessed with politics and power, and they really haven't been doing much to run the country, to put in the necessary reforms, to really try to move Ukraine forward. Moreover, the situation, it has costs for Ukraine, and sometimes it's not clear that this is appreciated. A couple of examples. 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of Commerce was due to visit Kyiv. He postponed that visit for very understandable reasons. You obviously don't want to go into Ukraine when you've got this huge fight where you might get pulled one way or the other, so you put it off. That would have been, however, the first visit by an American cabinet official to Kyiv since 2005. Now, that's not a fatal blow to U.S.-Ukraine relations, but it's an example of some of the costs this crisis is inflicting. Another example, which I think Ukraine needs to be concerned about, is the World Trade Organization. In December, the RADA, with really the unified votes of the Regions Party, Our Ukraine, and the Tymoshenko bloc, passed the legislation that Ukraine needed to pass to bring its trade regime into compliance with WTO standards. And then people then began saying, by April, May, Ukraine should check those final boxes and should be in WTO. Well, it's very likely that WTO is going to go back to the Ukrainians and say, in order to finish your transition to a WTO-compliant regime, you're probably going to have to tweak your legislation. And one can ask the question now, what does the RADA in its current situation do? Is it going to be capable of passing those laws? Even if the regions wanted to go ahead and do it, in the uncertain circumstances now, what legality does that vote have? Moreover, could they do it? Because the one party that was not inclined to support WTO-compliant legislation were the communists. So it might not even be possible in this rump RADA that now continues to meet to get a majority. A second set of concerns that one hears about is undoing the balance. And I think part of this is simply cultural. As Americans, we're much more comfortable with this notion of checks and balances between different branches of government. And there is a sense of unease that what we've seen happening over the last 6 or 7 months is an effort to undo the balance that was established by the 2004 constitutional reforms. Now, certainly, I think those reforms were flawed. They left ambiguities, they left gaps, and they're one of the reasons why we're in crisis today. But they basically created a balance between the president and the prime minister and between the president and the RADA that was welcome because it moved Ukraine away from the super presidency model that was abused badly in the Kuchma years. And I think there's unease now as we've seen, efforts by the majority in the RADA to remove powers from the president, to move into areas that the Constitution defines as presidential authorities, foreign policy, for example, that threatened to undo the balance that was created back in 2004. At the same time, there are also questions about some of the policies that the cabinet ministers has pursued, which raise questions about return of corruption. For example, lots of questions about the administration of the value-added tax, where there are many accounts that suggest that that policy of rebates for VAT is dictated in a discriminatory way to both regions and businesses that have links to the parties that are in the majority coalition in the RADA. A third set of concerns are simply uncertainties. And while I agree with Taras, I think Yushchenko probably found himself in a place on April 2nd where he felt he really was in a corner. But he has launched himself down a path which has a number of risks. I mean, there's some big mines out there. One is there are lots of questions, first of all, about the Constitutional Court. and whether it can be partial, questions about whether, in fact, it has been corrupted. But, the court could produce a couple of outcomes that would have questions. One, the court could decide that Yushchenko's decree of April 2nd is unconstitutional. And that presumably reverts the situation back to where things were on April 1. But that is going to have an impact on this balance between the president and the prime minister, because in those circumstances, it would be hard to see how Yushchenko's political power would not be weakened by that decision. So that's one outcome. A second outcome or possibility is, what if the Constitutional Court delays a decision, chooses not to rule? It could say, this is not a constitutional question, this is a political question, and basically kick it back to the president of the RADA. Or a quorum disappears. At one point last week, there was a question, would a number of judges decline to participate so that there could be no quorum? But if you don't get a constitutional court decision, and the president remains intent on early elections, and the RADA says no, that's a dilemma. Ukraine, I think, is then going to be on very uncertain territory, because you'll have a situation where you have the clash between the president and the legislative body, and the mechanism designed to arbitrate that clash, the Constitutional Court, is not doing its job. That'll be a dilemma for Ukraine, but I think it'll also be a dilemma for how the U.S. government addresses that situation, because at that point our answer of supporting a democratic process begins to break down. It doesn't provide a guide for how Ukraine should get out of the mess. The last set of uncertainties are, elections. No one knows what the results will be. Certainly, I think Tymoshenko and Yushchenko are calculating that the results of the election would be a restored orange coalition, an orange majority in the new RADA. But also, other outcomes are likely. I mean, a poll that showed yesterday suggests that, in fact, the new RADA would look pretty much like the current RADA, that you would have the socialists would be gone, but that between the Regent's Party and the Communists, there would still be a majority of the seats. So one ironic prospect of Yushchenko winning in the Constitutional Court, getting his early elections, is 4 months from now, the RADA could be suggesting that the prime minister would be Viktor Yanukovych. In any case, where I think this all comes together, my sense is that the U.S. government would like to see some form of compromise between Yushchenko and Yanukovych that might avert some of the more uncertain paths. And certainly we've seen Yushchenko and Yanukovych seem to be meeting every several days, although there's really no outward sign that they narrow the differences between them. But I think that compromise might offer the best way forward. And what might be elements of a compromise? Well, it might include early elections or not. That would be something for them to decide. I think it would probably have to include something with regards to the question of poaching RADA deputies. I don't see Yushchenko accepting a deal that leaves him back in the situation where he has to worry about further defections of members from either our Ukraine or the Tymoshenko bloc. That could lead to the majority coalition getting more than 300 and therefore having the power to change the Constitution. Hopefully the compromise would include some elements of agreement on policy, that where the sides could come together, probably not anything as grand as the universal, which was agreed back last August, but something where they could at least come onto agreement on some areas where the president, the prime minister, with the support of the RADA, would work together to try to push some economic and foreign policies that would be sensible for Ukraine. And as Taras said, I think it will be important that they at least put in a mechanism that addresses where the constitutional ambiguities and how do you fix them. Because if they don't address that problem in the longer term, there's no guarantee that 4 or 5 months from now, Ukraine will not find itself back in some other constitutional crisis. The last comment I'll make is just an observation, which I think this kind of crisis is not good for Ukraine and Ukraine's engagement with the United States or with the West, because the picture that Ukraine is conveying is of a country that is internally divided, fractious, obsessed with in fighting, but it's not giving anything for the West to engage with. And certainly I think from the perspective of the U.S. government now and other Western countries, as they look at Ukraine, they're following the situation, trying to understand it, but you don't have anybody spending a lot of time thinking, what are new initiatives that we can advance to try to bring Ukraine towards the vision that we see of a country more closely integrated into the Euro-Atlantic community? Because at this point, it's so unpredictable what Ukraine's going to look like in 2, 3, or 4 weeks. So there is, I think, a fear that from that policy sense, Ukraine is slipping off the Western radar. And that also is a cost for Ukraine of the current crisis. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve. Your conclusion that the current crisis is not good for Ukrainians and relations with the West and the United States is a perfect segue, I think, to our final panelist this morning, Dmitry Trenin, who will be looking at the question to some extent whether this crisis is good for Russia.
Well, thank you, Andy. Good morning. I don't think that the people in Russia would call it a welcome crisis, but it certainly is not unexpected to them. If anything, this is, in their view, a reflection of Ukrainian realities. They never bought the bulk of the people running Russia. They never bought the notion of an orange revolution as a democratic revolution, but rather as a reapportionment of power among the various Ukrainian clans. So what they see now is something that they have always expected, well, not always, but they've expected for some time, and something which is probably not the last crisis that Ukraine will go through. In that, they are more pessimistic than some of the people elsewhere. But more broadly, Russia's policy toward Ukraine is evolving, even as Russia is in transit from being an empire and thinking itself of an empire toward the Russia, the great power. In other words, rather than treating Ukraine as a former and potentially future part of some Russia-led entity under whatever name, they are treating Ukraine, as well as other former Soviet republics, as independent entities placed on Russian borders, where Russia has certain comparative advantages over other rivals, and Russia is prepared to use those advantages to push its own interests. Now, the interests that Russia has in Ukraine, I think, are more clearly defined now than they were in the past, and they include gas and oil transit, reliable gas and oil transit to the European Union, putting the relationship on a market basis, making sure that Ukraine pays an ever higher price and eventually a European-level price for the gas for the gas that receives from Russia. Acquiring industrial and some other assets in Ukraine, making sure that Ukraine is safe for Russian business, keeping Ukraine away from NATO membership and thus from slipping into the Western orbit, and thus turning the Russian-Ukrainian border into something like a dividing line between Europe and Russia, potentially using Ukrainian defense industrial assets in cooperation with the Russian defense industrial enterprises, keeping the Black Sea Fleet in Crimea at least until the lease expires in 2017. There are no plans to divide Ukraine. There are no plans to annex parts of Ukraine such as Crimea. Moscow is happy to live side by side with Ukraine, which maintains good relations with Europe and with Russia. Ironically, and very paradoxically, a post-revolutionary, i.e. pluralist, I think that they would prefer the word pluralist to the word democratic, Ukraine has turned out to be good news for Russia. Moscow can use various ways and instruments to advance its interests with its multiple Ukrainian partners. Since 2004, Moscow has been keeping lines of communication constantly open to all parties. There is clear preference for Yanukovych. There's an overlap of interests, very importantly on the NATO issue. There's a working relationship with President Yushchenko, not a very warm one perhaps, but quite correct from Moscow's perspective. There are contacts with Yulia Tymoshenko precisely because she is the player with the most energy and least predictability Those encounters with Tymoshenko could be a different kind, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But there's a clear change from a very foolish stand that Russia took in 2004 when it put all its eggs in one basket and essentially treated Viktor Yanukovych as if he were a pro-Russian candidate, which he was not. And I think that the Russians have learned the lesson that there can be no pro-Russian politician in Ukraine by definition. There are politicians in Ukraine who want faster integration with the West. There are politicians who want, let's say, a Ukraine which moves more slowly but essentially drifts toward Europe. But there are no politicians in Ukraine who would be pro-Russian. And this is something that the Russian leadership now takes quite calmly and is prepared to work on. As I said, the current crisis in Ukraine is not unexpected for Russia, and from Moscow's standpoint, so far it has not affected Russian material interests. Moscow's attitude to the crisis has been fairly calm. Again, if you compare that to the Russian attitude, not just to the 2004 election, but to the 2006 parliamentary election. There is close monitoring and old lines of communication with people like Medvedchuk and Tabachnik. At least that's what the media report are being used to keep a close to keep Ukraine at a close observation from the inside, if you like. There's verbal support for Yanukovych at the level of the Russian State Duma in particular. There is an attempt to mediate, although this is at a fairly low level. It's more like fact-finding missions that the Duma is sending rather than missions that are really prepared to mediate. The Russians realize that they have fairly limited leverage. As I said, Yanukovych is not pro-Russian, and he has his own reasons for pursuing the policies he is pursuing. But he is seen as a very useful ally, and there was no anxiety in Moscow, clearly, with Yanukovych using the salami tactic in the Rada, and that was fine from the Russian perspective. They realized that the issue of NATO membership cannot be decided by a small group of people. It will have to be, in some way and form, be decided with the participation of the Ukrainian population as a whole. And they realize that there's a difference in the way NATO is seen from, say, Ukraine on the one hand and Poland and the Baltic states on the other hand, precisely because the historical experience of Ukrainians with the Russians has been different, at least the bulk of Ukrainians and the Russians has been different than the experience of the Poles and the Balts. They are fairly relaxed on the issue of democracy. Again, they never bought the notion of a revolution. They thought of it as more of a U.S.-sponsored plot within the larger struggle for power in Ukraine. But they're quite relaxed on that issue. Pluralist policy has arrived. Politics has arrived in Ukraine, and that's, as I said, is good news for Russia. And I think that there's the fingers that Moscow burnt in 2004 are still, I wouldn't say aching, but there's still a memory of that. So I think that there's an understanding that should Moscow try to meddle more, actually should it try to meddle in a serious way, that could be counterproductive. So let the Ukrainians sort things out themselves. I think that the Russians would be protesting against Western interference in Ukrainian politics. They would prefer to keep the Ukrainians to themselves and let them decide on or not decide whatever should be done about the constitutional crisis. The Russian Foreign Ministry has decided to publish, as Andy mentioned, a very rare rebuttal of a journal article by Yulia Tymoshenko, and quite frankly, we speculated about the reasons for that among ourselves. My view of that is that that could be a reflection of the Munich-style in-your-face response. You don't let those blows unanswered. That could be one explanation. Another partial explanation could be that they're trying to highlight an apparently anti-Russian statement by Yulia Tymoshenko, hoping that by drawing attention to that, she could lose some support in Ukraine's east. And then, I think, very importantly, there are some suspicions about American authors, co-authors, or American input into this article. And I believe that there is a feeling in Moscow that important factions in the United States are ready to go for a tougher policy line toward Russia. And this is a response not so much to Yulia Tymoshenko as to some people in Washington. And very lastly, implications for Russian-Western relations from this crisis. I don't think that Moscow's current policy, should they continue the way they have been evolving, are likely to exacerbate the crisis in Ukraine. Russia is generally confident that whatever the outcome of the crisis, she will be able to protect its key interests in Ukraine. However, should the crisis deteriorate into violence, which is very unlikely at this stage, then outsiders, including Russia, will be sucked in, and in the worst outcome, Ukraine could become a political battlefield, and with some input from the outsiders, and I think that would be the worst outcome also for Russia. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dmitry, for bringing a very insightful perspective on Russian interests in this. Dmitry, I take it that the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs did not publish an official response to your excellent article in Foreign Affairs from last year?
He just refused him a visa to go back.
Okay. We have about 35, 40 minutes for discussion. So let me open the floor to our audience and with the request that you identify yourself for our panelists, and let me turn first to Steve Larrabee.
I'd like to ask all panelists, but particularly I'll direct it towards Dmitry. You said that essentially Russia has no plans to annex Crimea or any other place, and of course I would agree with that. But on the other hand, I'd like to ask you about all three impressions about Russian policy towards Crimea, and particularly I'm thinking of the statement by Putin back in October where he raised the question of ethnic problems in Crimea and said that Russia would be ready to help and provide assistance if this were needed. This sort of reminds one of the old Brezhnev doctrine and so forth. And then also the fact that Putin raised the question back in October, almost out of the blue, of extending the Black Sea Fleet. What do you make of these statements and the fact that there are still problems where some Russian politicians still try to go to Crimea without getting a visa and so forth? What's behind all of this? Obviously not annexation, but what are they trying to do? So I'd ask to all three, but particularly Dmitry.
Dmitry, why don't you take that one on first, and we'll turn to the other two panelists.
Well, thank God that there are no visas for any Russians traveling to Ukraine or for any Ukrainians traveling to Russia. I think that Putin was actually that was if I remember correctly, at that time we were still the Ukrainians and the Russians were still discussing the parameters of their economic relationships. So I think that Putin was laying on the table the interest that Russia has in continuing the lease of the of Sevastopol and continuing the lease of the facilities for the Black Sea Fleet. I think that that's a Russian, longstanding Russian interest. I mentioned that interest. I think it has also something to do with the with both the situation in Crimea, which is ethnically predominantly Russian, and the Black Sea Fleet is a factor in all that. It's also a factor in the wider scheme of things. The Russians would very much would go to great lengths to prevent Ukraine from sliding into the NATO camp, and the Black Sea Fleet is an element of that policy. Russian mediation and Russian self-invitations to mediate, I think, reflect the growing assertiveness of Russian foreign policy. I believe that they will be coming up with those offers on a wider range of issues than before. So they think that they are playing, as I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks, they are starting to play the role of a great power. And that is different from the role of an empire. In other words, if you like, they are taking more of a Western approach, traditional Western European approach, rather than the traditional Russian approach to the borderlands as part of your realm. It's not part of the realm. It's a territory which is which is a playground for various interests, and the Russians are less shy than ever before to play in that playground. That's how I would interpret that.
Sure. I think there's two issues here. I think whereas I would agree that there isn't a formal policy of annexing territory, at the same time, if you look at it from a Kiev point of view, the constant visits by people like Mayor Lushkov, who, after all, again from a Kiev point of view, is a high-ranking, I think, number five or so on the party of United Russia. So from a Kiev point of view, they don't separate Lushkov from Putin. Lushkov is very much part of that Putin close circle. And they do remember Lushkov as coming to Severodonetsk in November 2004 and supporting the Separatist Congress in Donetsk, organized by Yanukovych. So his constant arrivals in Crimea and his constant claims on Crimean territory certainly, I think, play into that fear, which is quite widespread in the Ukrainian elites and has been all along since the 1990s, that Russia hasn't come to terms with Ukraine's territorial integrity, at least in the Crimea. And it builds into a fear of what will happen if there's even a more nationalistic president comes to power if Putin leaves office next year. And the whole issue of Black Sea Fleet again feeds into that question, because currently the Black Sea Fleet cannot remain after 2017 because it's under a temporary clause in the Ukrainian constitution. For Russia to have a permanent base in Sevastopol, the constitution would have to be changed. That requires 300 votes. That's an added factor why Yushchenko is concerned or would be concerned about the anti-crisis coalition obtaining constitutional majority. It's not just that they would then move maybe possibly to a parliamentary republic, Russian state language, but also changing the clause on the Black Sea Fleet in the Ukrainian constitution. But a second factor is something I was told during the week of the crisis. I happened to be in Kiev during that week, flew in on the same day as the decree. And this was told to me by somebody in the presidential secretariat, which I think is more disturbing. They certainly believe, on the intelligence provided to them by the Ukrainian security service, that Viktor Yanukovych's actions are closely coordinated with the Russian presidential administration. Now, again, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it's certainly the widespread belief in the Ukrainian presidential administration. And the fact that it's believed is in some ways more important than whether it's true. And that is, I think, a more disturbing. And let's not forget, Dmitry didn't mention this, but I think what's important to know is that in 2005, Party of Regions signed an agreement, a cooperative agreement with Unified Russia in that. So, you know, although Russia is relatively more standoffish than it was in 2004, it still has a favorite candidate in the country.
Yeah, I would add two comments. First, I would agree with Dmitry that I think Russian policy towards Ukraine, as we've seen it in the last few weeks, is much more sophisticated, much smarter than it was, say, 3 years ago, where, remember, before both the first and the second rounds of the Ukrainian elections in 2004, Vladimir Putin went to Ukraine on what were barely described campaign trips on behalf of Yanukovych, which I think actually probably had a backlash that was not what the Russians intended. The second comment, when I look at sort of as Russia looks at Crimea, is I do think that the Russians have to be very careful there because there is this danger for Russia of overplaying its hand. And I'd go back to the example of September 2003 in Tuzla Island, a little tiny spit of land that – a little tiny island, formerly a spit of land that no one in the State Department had heard of until September of 2003. But a piece of real estate that under the laws going back to 1925 clearly was defined as Ukrainian territory, and the Russians set off to build a causeway to link this island to the Russian mainland. And I remember a comment that was voiced privately at the time by a pro-Russian senior Ukrainian official who basically said, if the Russians succeed and that causeway reaches Tuzla Island, they're to be congratulated because they will have created 49 million Ukrainian nationalists. And I think the Russians have to be careful about that.
Yes, right here.
Eric Boyle with the Eurasia Foundation. I have a question for Taras. I want to know if you could comment on the Ukrainian left's institutional or philosophical underpinnings for their desire to have a parliamentary republic. It seems, from my own perspective, it seems to be more of a power issue or a personality issue among the political elites. And it seems that if by some miracle a Maroz or a Simonenko were actually in the presidency, they would have a different opinion about the power of the presidency.
I think it's a general rule that in post-Soviet, I don't know if it's in post-communist countries, but it's certainly in post-Soviet countries, that the left has tended to be against the very institution of presidency, believing that the councils, the supreme councils, and the Soviet system of councils is the better way to have a political system. And so they've always been very unhappy with the very introduction of a presidential system. So I think, yes, of course, it's a question of power, but it's, I think, from a socialist and communist point of view, it's also an ideological factor. And let's not forget that, or let's recall that the Socialist Party, although taking part in anti-Kuchma demonstrations in 2002-2003, together with Tymoshenko bloc and Our Ukraine, was also at the same time involved in negotiations and consultations with the pro-Kuchma majority in supporting constitutional reform. So that they had a multi-vector policy as well as that. So I think there are ideological factors. I think with the communists, it's even deeper. They do believe Yushchenko's a CIA agent. I mean, that's just the way the communists are. And so you have what you have, which I think is a part of this crisis, is we have the coalition that came to power is a coalition nobody expected. We expected it to be either Orange or Grand. Suddenly this new thing appeared called Anti-Crisis Coalition in the summer of last year. And this coalition is the least democratic and the worst of the three. And it's the only one of the three where Yanukovych is prime minister. And hence, it's not surprising that both Yanukovych and the socialists, who are unlikely to enter the new parliament, are very opposed to the idea of new elections, because I think they may not return to the anti-crisis coalition that they have at the moment. So I think it's a mixture of things. You're right, power-grabbing, ideological, and just the very composition of this coalition.
Yeah. Ruslan Petrychko, Voice of America. How would you comment the latest statement made by Yushchenko earlier today that he's ready to take back his decision to dissolve the parliament if some of his political demands are met by parliament and Yanukovych? The statement was made earlier today, a couple of hours ago.
I mean, I think it's very early to comment on this decision. I mean, I think it's one of the fears that certainly in the more, shall we say, radical camp of Tymoshenko, it's certainly one of the fears that here we go again, Viktor Yushchenko's backing off. If he was to do so, it would be the equivalent, I think, in terms of his popularity, of having a negative ruling in the Constitutional Court. He would become a marginalized figure. Tymoshenko would probably break with him. And this would be Tymoshenko's grab for 2009. I think Yushchenko's in a very difficult position here. If he does move in that direction, he could be severely undermined even within his own camp, because our Ukraine itself, as I've mentioned, has changed in the last few months as well. So I think you're referring to a news item which I still don't think we know everything about. And as we know in Ukrainian politics, I would wait a few days, check from more than one source, and knowing Yushchenko, he's probably change his mind tomorrow.
Steve, did you want to comment on that?
No, I would agree with Trost's last observation that, you know, we need to get a little bit more clarity here. But I think I'm not so sure that I would say that this would be a negative development. I mean, the question is, you have to see what the terms are. I mean, if I could conceive of an arrangement where if he brokered certain agreements from Yanukovych, that he might be able to withdraw his decree in a way that he could explain and say, look, this is actually the best way forward. So the question is, we're sort of operating in the dark. You've seen that one statement, but you know, in terms of what an actual agreement, you know, that would emerge that might lead him to withdraw that, before rendering a judgment, I think we've got to see those terms.
Yeah, in the back.
Nadia McConnell, U.S. Ukraine Foundation. Steve, I'm going to take one of your comments as a way to challenge representatives here of our government and ask for commentary from the panel.
From them?
Yes. No, from the panel. The statement you made that the interest of the United States today regarding Ukraine is no less than what it was, whatever time frame you named. I challenge that because it seems to me that we have either never understood or have forgotten the main one of the main accomplishments that we saw of the Orange Revolution, and that was the maturing of civil society in Ukraine. And that, we hope, is a lasting change. If that is true, then all of these things that we're looking to, the solving of constitutional reform, Euro-Atlantic integration, NATO membership, that will only come about with the engagement of civil society. Otherwise, these agreements at the top will be just another series of broken agreements between vying political forces. And if you look at the budget of 70 million assistance versus what it was, 100 and some, which again are very piddly sums, to me it seems we are undercutting the success of what we saw in civil society, because it is only by the engagement of civil society in these questions will there perhaps be, if not a permanent, but certainly maybe a more lasting conclusion to what the Ukrainians want.
Steve, you want to take that one first?
Yeah, let me offer two observations. I mean, first, I think within the U.S. government, the budget world for Ukraine and for that entire region now is just very, very difficult. I mean, things have changed in the last 5 years in the aftermath of 9/11. And I saw this when I was still in government in 2003, 2004, was there was a shift in U.S. assistance resources in a shift in funding for exchange programs, things that we thought were very valuable for Ukraine and the former Soviet space, were beginning to orient more towards, you know, the Muslim world. And you know, again, that's consistent, I think, with a U.S. foreign policy agenda now, which is increasingly looks at areas other than Ukraine and the former Soviet space. If, you know, were you to ask the White House, what are the five foreign policy priorities, I suspect the list would be Iraq, Iran, Middle East peace process, Afghanistan, North Korea.
Iraq.
Okay, yeah. But in any case, so that overall focus, and unfortunately, Ukraine, you know, has to compete in the world of assistance funding now with those sort of areas. So it's fallen lower down on the priority level. I guess the second observation, though, and this could be an incorrect judgment. You know, we'll see. But you know, my own sense is that civil society in Ukraine is actually getting fairly well established. And you know, hopefully, I mean, what we wanted to see when we had these assistance programs going in Ukraine when I was there back in the 1990s, I mean, you don't want to create civil society institutions and NGOs that are forever dependent on Western or American support for their existence. I mean, ultimately, if this is going to succeed, they've got to become self-sustaining. And to some extent, I think, you know, there's a certain confidence level that, you know, Ukraine has made progress where, you know, obviously more funding would help, but that you know, the reduced funding, you know, is not going to be fatal for civil society in Ukraine. And that's a proposition that can be debated. You know, we may have a chance to sort of see how civil society performs over the next couple of months.
Iraq. I thought you were going to break into that famous Beach Boys song for a second, Steve. Let's turn to Terrace for a comment on this also.
Yeah, I think there's a different angle to this, and I would argue that the potential major influence, positive influence on Ukraine, which is far greater than any U.S. assistance that could provide, whether even it's double the amount now, is the European Union. I mean, I come from Britain, where it's a national sport to bash the European Union, but let me just refer even to this open letter of International Herald and Tribune on Tuesday, where they say to their fellow European Union members of Parliament, and the European Parliament has been more radical than the European Union itself in pushing for Ukraine to have the carrot of potential future membership. This is what they say. We have to accept the European Union has not done enough to prevent this crisis from developing. Whereas other European countries that made the transition from Soviet rule to democracy benefited from substantial political and material support, Ukraine has been asked to overcome a very difficult political legacy largely on its own. And the fact is, Ukraine today is Romania without an EU carrot. And you know, countries which were the laggards in Central Eastern European reform, like Bulgaria, Slovakia, Romania, all had the potential carrot of EU membership. And that carrot kind of pulled them along through very difficult times. Let's remember that in Romania, Iliescu dominated the post-Ceausescu era. And Romania is a far even worse case example than Ukraine. Iliescu sent coal miners to beat up demonstrators, pro-democracy demonstrators in Bucharest. And yet they were coached along to the European Union. I think the European Union here really has to pull its finger out. I mean, they did not change their policy after the Orange Revolution, and I think this is one of the... If there's something that can be of great assistance to Ukraine in terms of its democratic development, it really has to be the European Union.
Thanks, Terrace. I'm sure that bashing the EU would be a popular sport in this town also if we actually knew what it was. Yes.
We're not that clear in Britain.
Wanted to know, we haven't talked about the United States military, and insofar as you're talking about NATO, that would seem to play a significant role. And since a U.S. general responsible for defense missiles has visited Ukraine, this suggests that there is, despite the political aspect, there is a developing military and strategic aspect that's a source of money, that's a source of irritation for the Russians, and that's a source of policy for the United States. And I just wanted to know whether any of the panel members had anything to say about that, because as we know, the United States military has a lot of money there.
Stephen, you want to start with that?
No, certainly. I mean, throughout the 90s and I think on up to the present, military engagement between the United States and Ukraine has been a very positive aspect of the relationship. And I don't think this was ever intended to be anti-Russian. I mean, I recall the 1990s, U.S.-Ukrainian military programs typically were 3 to 4 times the size of U.S.-Russian engagements. But in both cases, both Russia and the Ukrainians were offered the same engagement menu. The Ukrainians just tended to choose a lot, and the Russians didn't. And in fact, at some points, we thought the Ukrainians chose too much. We sort of counseled them, take a smaller number of activities, but do them a little bit better. I think that engagement has continued. It seems to be, on a much more routine basis. I would note it was rather interesting that despite the current crisis, the RADA did go ahead and vote to approve the law allowing military exercises this year, which presumably would open the way for some of the exercises that turned out to be problematic in the summer of 2006 when the law had not been passed. The other thing, I thought the Obrin visit was, part of this. I mean, I think he went there in part to ensure that the missile defense issue did not become a problem in Ukraine. And certainly, whereas there has been going back 4 or 5 years, talk of possible missile defense cooperation between the United States and Ukraine, no one that I'm aware of had ever envisaged deploying either interceptors or radars into Ukraine. So I think his visit there was useful in just sort of clarifying that point. But I would expect that military-to-military engagement seems to be going on a fairly regular, established pattern, and it's a good thing for the relationship.
I think there's another aspect to it as well, which we can bring in, which is the fact that the now a 13-year relationship, both in PFP and in the spirit of PFP on a bilateral basis, that Ambassador Pfeiffer referred to, and the same kind of high-level bilateral military relationship has been done by Britain. A colleague of mine, James Sher, who's been involved in this, has said that even in the case of Britain, it was higher with Ukraine than with Russia for the same kind of reasons. And the positive aspects of this are that this is more likely to lead up to a peaceful, nonviolent outcome of these kind of crises, as it did in 2004. When Kuchma or Yanukovych, we still don't know, sent special forces of the Ministry of the Interior to crush the Orange Revolution on the 28th of November 2004, it was the commander of Ukrainian ground forces who intervened and said, we're defending the Ukrainian Revolution. And that, although it's not been quantified, that has to be a consequence of both that commander's participation in these kind of exchanges and the 13-year relationship and cooperative relationship between NATO and Western countries and Ukraine, which has changed the mentality of Ukrainian officers to a far greater degree than, say, in Russia. And I think that those kind of aspects mean that the intrusion of the law enforcement and security forces in these kind of crises is far less. So there's been a kind of a democratization or civilianization of those officer corps, which, of course, is exemplified by the current defense minister, Mr. Hrytsenko, who himself was a product of these exchanges.
Dmitry, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that the Russians wanted a different kind of engagement and different terms. I think part of the frustration that Putin feels is that he essentially asked for, informally, of course, but very clearly, he asked for NATO membership for Russia. And he was shunned. And then he sort of realized where everyone stood. They were not interested in doing small things little by little. They think that they have, that they can ask for a different kind of deal. No, that was not forthcoming. So that explains the different quality of relations between Russia and NATO, Russia and the U.S. in the military field, and Russia and Ukraine and the West in the military field. And on the issue of ballistic missile defenses, essentially the Russians are asking for
a plan that would include them in the system. And they feel that they have something to bring to the table. The Secretary of Defense is coming to Moscow to talk about these issues. And we'll see what the outcome will be. But if the outcome is no, then I think it will be seen as a signal that you do not belong, really. I think you're right. The enhancement of Ukrainian NATO, Ukrainian U.S. military relations is seen as an irritation in Moscow. There's no way it could be seen otherwise.
I'd like to take the prerogative of the chair and ask the panel a question concerning the upcoming Russian presidential elections scheduled for a little less than a year from now. There was a long interview that I'm sure most people in this room saw with Sergei Ivanov, one of the purported candidates, who's denied it many times in the Financial Times yesterday, who made a rather disdainful remark about Ukrainian politics and suggested that Ukraine would be better off with a czar. But my question is, from the standpoint of Kiev, what are the calculations and expectations about the outcome of the likely transfer of power in Moscow? And then vice versa, to what extent will the situation in Ukraine and for Ukraine play any kind of role in the Russian electoral cycle coming up in December 2007 for the Duma and March 2008 for the presidency?
This, of course, presupposes that in Kyiv they have time to think about things like the Russian election.
And it presupposes that Putin leaves office.
Take it any way you want.
I think the latter part, I don't think Russia can be, you know, the one potential scenario that could have impacted upon the Russian elections would have been Ukraine receiving a membership action plan from NATO last year at Riga. And in 2008 at the NATO Enlargement Summit, whether that would be before or after the Russian presidential elections, with an invitation to Ukraine to join, which was the original, shall we say, Bush administration fast-track approach. If Ukraine had not been the way it has, if Ukraine had not had the five crises and had created the Orange Coalition last year, then I think they may have been.
If Ukraine were not Ukraine.
Right. And we all know Kuchma's famous 2004 book, Ukraine is Not Russia, to which Putin is writing a sequel, Russia is Not Ukraine. I think that scenario with Ukraine on a fast-track membership to NATO, that would have been maybe some kind of impact upon 2008 Russia. But because that's not on the cards, I don't see what and because these domestic crises in Ukraine are in effect paralyzing Ukraine foreign policy, then I don't see what can really impact negatively on 2008 or have any impact on 2008. If anything, it'll impact in the wrong way. Because I think one of the things that Dmitry kind of hinted at but didn't really mention is I think the perennial crises in Ukraine after the Orange Revolution are music to the ears of the anti-Orangists in Moscow who have said, we told you so. This is something that's going to lead to these perennial crises. It's not going to be stable, and therefore this is not something that we really want to have in Russia. It kind of discredits the very idea of democratic revolution taking place inside Russia, and that would be the impact, but it's obviously the wrong impact that we want to have. And that certainly, when you look at opinion polls of young people in Russia who support more Putin than the idea of a democratic revolution, that unfortunately is the negative influence.
Yeah, I'd add two comments. I mean, you know, first of all, in looking at how Ukrainian politicians, be it in the presidential secretariat, the cabinet, or the Rada, have acted and how they've talked over the last 4 or 5 months, it doesn't seem to me that what will happen in Russia in terms of the elections next year is having a huge impact on how they're either behaving or the sorts of policy options they're talking about. So, you know, my sense is that they kind of take that as a given, but it's not a big a big factor in shaping the sorts of policies that they're trying to pursue. The second thing, and I really can't give you a reason why for this, but I do think that if part of the solution to Ukraine's current constitutional crisis involves early elections, I think it would be better for both for Ukraine, but also perhaps for Russia, if those elections were held in June, July, September, earlier October, but they were off the board before you had the Duma elections and then the presidential elections in Russia next year. I'm not sure that having those elections run concurrent would be a good thing.
I think that the Russian leadership has to be careful, because at the back of their minds, they realize that they have emerged, and the Russian Revolution, the Russian Federation has emerged from a kind of revolution, which is in many ways very close to what we saw in 2004 in Kiev. What happened in 1991, and which is not something that the people in the Kremlin like to talk very much about, is what was a revolution. And it was a similar kind of civil society rising against the regime. So they have to be careful. They sit atop something which is similar to what they are demolishing verbally. Second, I think that Russian politicians have now adopted a habit of speaking plainly. Which is fine if you're an analyst. I think you get better insights, and I think sometimes they speak their mind. And this disdain that people express for Ukraine is a reflection of their overconfidence, self-confidence, and bordering sometimes on overconfidence. And this is. This Mr. Ivanov is just one example of that. Responding to Andy's questions, I think that if things in Moscow go according to Plan A, which is a transfer of power within the ruling circle, which I think is far more probable than any other scenario at this point. The impact of that on relations with Ukraine or policy toward Ukraine will be minimal, because foreign policy guidelines are being laid down now. Actually, President Putin, being a responsible authoritarian leader, is making sure that once he leaves, and I think he wants to leave, whether he manages, it's a difficult, the Kremlin is a difficult place to get in, but sometimes it's difficult to get out. So if he manages to, if he manages to leave, then I think he wants to make sure that the house that he has built does not crumble, does not fall apart. And that's why they're passing three-year budgets. That's why they're extending the tenure of the pension age chief of the general staff by another 3 years. The Munich speech, which lays down Russia's foreign policy, the foreign policy review, everything for the first 2 years into the next presidency. That will be the crucial time for the emergence and the maturing of the new president of Russia. So I think it's responsible, and I'm not joking. I think it's a responsible attitude. Under the circumstances, so I don't. I would not expect any changes as far as Ukraine is concerned. And very lastly, and I hope it will not come to that, but should the situation in Ukraine become violent, that would be I don't think it will happen. But should it become violent, then I think it will have an impact on Russia. It will have an impact on Russia's policy toward Ukraine, and I think that's absolutely the worst scenario that we all need to be very careful to avoid. Thank you.
Yeah. There's just one angle that we should bring in on the foreign policy side, which maybe Corey could
very quietly sitting there, but maybe you could comment on. I think that the foreign policy paralysis in Ukraine and the stagnation in the drive to NATO membership as a consequence of these various crises has an impact on Georgia. And I'm wondering whether Corey could elaborate on this, because originally the thought was that five countries would maybe be brought into NATO in 2008, with two CIS, three Western Balkan. Now it looks likely just to be three Western Balkan. And so the question is, can Georgia move towards NATO without Ukraine? Is Georgia in a group forever with Ukraine? If it is, then you'll have a few problems. I mean, Georgia's in some ways in a better situation than Ukraine, because it has 70% domestic support for NATO membership, unlike 20% in Ukraine. But at the same time, usually the two countries are brought together because they are the two only CIS countries that seek to move in that direction. So,
Corey, have you had your coffee? Would you like a microphone?
I mean, I think you're right. It does pose some difficulties in Georgia, and Saakashvili's been trying to dance a very delicate dance around Ukraine, and I think in two different directions, which somehow set up some competing foreign policy challenges. On the one side, he's looking for friends to the east, so he's developing the Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Georgia bloc, which really has a lot less to do with NATO. And on the other side, just trying to establish Georgia more clearly, not as one of the two post-Soviet states that have NATO prospects, but as part of the larger curve around through the Balkans and those Eastern European states that have already become members. But it's tough, and perhaps the only merit his advantage is that it is such a small country, and perhaps he can disassociate himself to some degree from Ukraine and say, look, we're a lot easier of a country to deal with, in fact, even though that might be paradoxical to those of us who know the country.
It's a moving issue.
Steve, do you want to pass your microphone to Steve there? I mean, Corey, to Steve, sorry.
Actually, I actually think it's easier that when they're separated, Georgia. I mean, Georgia is tied to Ukraine. Ukraine is a huge strategic issue with Russia and so forth. If it's independent of that, it's possible to sneak it in some way. But the real problem, I think, is obviously Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and that remains independently of anything to do with Ukraine. Mm-hmm. If it weren't for the Abkhazia and South Ossetia, I think then, Georgia could look like, Albania or Macedonia or something. No one wouldn't care that much. But those two issues obviously are very, very important, have larger implications.
Right. And my guess is that Russia will do what it can to ensure that
they remain frozen.
Okay, I'm afraid that we've run out of time for our session this morning. But let me take this opportunity to thank our panelists, Steve, Dimitri, and Teres, for really a terrific discussion. And thank all of you for coming this early Friday morning on a beautiful spring day. And we look forward to seeing you again sometime soon, hopefully not to discuss too soon another Ukrainian political crisis. Thank you.
See you in the fall. Part two is in the fall.